We were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, when about midnight the sailors sensed they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that we would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea. Pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow, then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved." So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it drift away. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. "For the last 14 days," he said, "you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head." After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach, where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them into the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plans. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or on other pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached land safely.
We're continuing with this journey to Rome that Paul was making by ship. It wasn't a cruise. He was a prisoner of the Romans, being taken by Roman soldiers to trial before Caesar in Rome. As we've seen over the past couple of weeks, it was an extremely difficult journey, particularly so because of the time of year that they were undertaking it. Last week, we saw that a storm, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster, swept down on the ship. The ship was caught by the storm and driven along by it. The soldiers took various measures to try to lighten the ship and even passed ropes underneath it to try to hold it together. But the storm was ferocious. Neither the sun nor the stars appeared for many days, and the storm continued raging. And finally, they gave up all hope of being saved. Was this to be the end for Paul? But then Paul had a vision. "Last night, an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you.'" I wonder if you're a glass half empty person or a glass half full person. Do you focus on the negatives or the positives? If you'd been there on that ship, what would you have thought? The situation was a complete disaster. There was absolutely no hope of rescue. But this prisoner said that his God had told him that you would be saved. What would you have thought? Well, things didn't get any better. On the 14th night, they were still being driven across the sea when, about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. The sea was getting rapidly shallower and shallower, and they were afraid they would be dashed against the rocks. So they let down an anchor to try to slow the ship down. Then when that anchor was straining unbearably, they let down another one, four anchors altogether. Archaeologists have found sequences of anchors like this, four anchors in a line, some distance apart, and finally, a wrecked ship. But a wrecked ship that might have crashed into the rocks even more fiercely without being slowed down in this way. Then the sailors tried to launch the lifeboat so they could escape from the ship. It was a bad enough situation, but it would have become a lot worse if there hadn't been anyone left to even try to sail the ship. And Paul pointed that out to the centurion. And so to stop them, the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it fall away. Just before dawn, Paul encouraged the people on board to eat. For the past 14 days, they'd been in constant suspense and hadn't eaten anything. And you could understand that the force of the storm and probable seasickness, particularly among the soldiers and prisoners, wouldn't have made eating a very attractive idea. But Paul urged them to eat, as they wouldn't survive whatever lay ahead of them without proper nourishment. So he took bread, gave thanks to God in front of them all, broke it and began to eat. And they were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. And then, having eaten their fill, they proceeded to lighten the ship as much as possible by throwing the remainder of the grain overboard. And now we discover for the first time just how many people were on board this ship, 276 altogether. It seems such a lot of people, but it's not an unusual number for such a ship. Josephus, the historian, gives an account of a similar voyage in a ship which was shipwrecked in much the same place, which had 600 people on board. When daylight came, they found they were in sight of land, although they had no idea where they were. They saw a bay with a beach, which they thought would be a suitable spot to run the ship aground if they could. So they cut loose the anchors, leaving them in the sea, and tied the ropes that held the rudders, hoisted the sail, and made for the beach. But the ship ran aground on a sandbar. It stuck fast and wouldn't move, and its stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the waves. And then the soldiers decided to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. Tom Wright says he always gets cross when he reads this verse. "For goodness sake," I want to say to the soldiers, "you've all been through so much together. You've got to know one another these last weeks. You've helped throw things overboard side by side. You've had moments of teasing and grumbling and sharing memories. You've become friends in an odd sort of way. How can you now, when rescue is within reach, turn round and kill these prisoners in cold blood?" But that's what Roman soldiers did. They killed people. They were responsible for the safekeeping of the prisoners in their charge, and if they had allowed the prisoners to escape, their own lives would have been on the line. Paul's life was at risk from shipwreck and drowning. It was now also at risk from the soldiers. But the centurion must have realized that he had in his care one of the most unusual prisoners he had ever met. He had treated Paul kindly right from the start, and now he saved his life. "Let the prisoners get safe to land along with the others," he said. "Those who could swim should dive overboard and swim ashore. The rest can float ashore on planks and spars." One way or another, they all reached land and safety. The supernatural promise which had been made to Paul in their darkest hour had been fulfilled to the letter. The ship and its cargo were lost, but every life on board was saved. The traditional site of the shipwreck is St. Paul's Bay on the northeast coast of Malta. At the entrance to the bay, there is a sandbar. It's now much lower than it was in Paul's time, but it could well be the place where the vessel ran aground. There's an old book called The Voyage and Shipwreck of St. Paul, written by a man called James Smith, who was an experienced sailor, very well acquainted with that part of the Mediterranean. And he has been able to describe very accurately where the ship was at each point during this voyage and what was happening to it. And his account corresponds almost exactly with how Luke describes each part of the journey. There's another great scholar of about a century ago, Sir William Ramsay, who has carried out a great deal of archaeological research in this area. And he says this: "The foreship was held together until every passenger got safe to dry land. Only the rarest conjunction of favorable circumstances could have brought about such a fortunate ending to their apparently hopeless situation. And one of the completest services that has ever been rendered to New Testament scholarship is James Smith's proof that all these circumstances are united in St. Paul's Bay." In other words, what happened to this ship and where it landed was pretty miraculous. Only the rarest conjunction of favorable circumstances could have brought it about. So four brief thoughts about storms. Firstly, last week we saw the quiet voice of God in the storm. The wind was howling and the waves were crashing, but Paul had heard the quiet voice of God. Remember Elijah on the mountain where he fled after the dramatic contest on Mount Carmel? After the storm and the earthquake came the gentle whisper of God, the quiet voice that told him that it would all be okay. In our storms of life, do we know that gentle whisper, the quiet voice of God that tells us that he is with us, that it's all going to be okay? When we do hear his voice, does that mean that the storm we are in is about to end immediately? Well, no, it probably doesn't, no matter how much we might want it to. Paul heard the voice of God, but there was still so much to cope with. Many days of storm, still a shipwreck ahead of him. But the quiet voice of God had said it was going to be okay. And in the end, okay was what it was. There's an old hymn that says, "And his the gentle voice we hear, soft as the breath of even, that checks each thought and calms each fear and speaks of heaven." The quiet voice of God. Secondly, where do we put our trust? I read this the other day in the magazine of the Evangelical Alliance. Life can feel quite overwhelming sometimes. Over the past few years, it seems we have been hit by storm after storm, from the cost of living crisis to wars on our doorstep, from large-scale natural disasters to the more personal disasters we may be facing. We are experiencing something experts are calling a state of perma-crisis, a permanent state of alert and sense of uncertainty. As the waves crash and the things that have given us stability get eroded, it leaves our foundations exposed. We get to see what our lives are really built upon, our values, our experiences, our faith. There's a story told of a sailor who had been shipwrecked, who clung to a rock as the waves battered it and the storm raged around him. When eventually he was rescued, a friend asked him, "Didn't you shake with fear when you were hanging on to the rock?" He replied, "Yes, I did, but the rock never shook once." Life and its storms and uncertainties may cause us to shake, but God, who is the rock of ages, will never move. If we cling to him, his strength will sustain us. Psalm 91 says, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust." In the storm, we hang on to God, but are there things we should throw away? The people on the ship threw overboard everything they could to try to lighten the ship. Are there things we are hanging on to that we should be throwing overboard? Sins, maybe, things that weigh us down, things that cause us to doubt or to seek help elsewhere. The writer to the Hebrews says, "Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus." But lastly, we see the providence of God. Providence, God's care and protection, his foresight, his provision, his divine intervention. He had said it would be okay, and it was. But yet there were times of real danger for Paul and his companions. The ship could have broken up at any moment. It could have been dashed against the rocks. The sailors planned to escape in the lifeboat and abandon everyone else. The soldiers intended to kill the prisoners. But the ship didn't break up. It wasn't dashed against the rocks. The soldiers stopped the sailors escaping in the lifeboat, and the centurion saved Paul's life from the soldiers planning to kill him. In all these situations of possible disaster, they were saved. Remember a couple of weeks ago, Alistair commented on the kindness of the centurion. How did it come to be that the centurion assigned to take Paul to Rome was a kind man? I don't imagine there were many kind centurions in the Roman Empire. Their work was violent and no doubt hardened them. Is this not evidence of the grace and providence of God that such a man should have been put in charge of Paul, a man who would go on to save his life? And the ship came to its end in St. Paul's Bay, not out in the middle of the Mediterranean where all would have been lost. How did it come to be that, as Sir William Ramsay said, the rarest conjunction of favourable circumstances brought about a fortunate ending to their apparently hopeless situation? Only by the providence of God. As we look at the world today, there are undoubtedly great storms. Maybe there are even shipwrecks. Our hearts break for what has happened in Israel and for what is even now happening in Gaza. No one can tell what the outcome will be. All I can say is that there in the shipwreck that Paul experienced, we see the providence of God. Somehow, we need to hold on to our trust in him and in his providence in the world. Our God is the Ancient of Days. None above him, none before him, all of time in his hands, for his throne it shall remain and ever stand. All the power, all the glory, I will trust in his name, for my God is the Ancient of Days.